Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Let's go ahead and get started. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the session called Muckrakers, The Life and Times of Warren Hinkle. I want to thank our sponsor, Will Hearst Journal of Alta California. I know about the online version. I see some of the print versions on the seats here. This is a new journal devoted to California, politics and current affairs. And I know there are at least two articles that are relevant to our talk today. One is by David McCumber, who worked with Warren Hinkle at the San Francisco Examiner. And the other is from Terry McDonald's superb memoir, which is called The Accidental Life. So I encourage you all to check that out online if it's not in the hard copy that's in the seats. My name is Peter Richardson. I teach humanities and American studies at San Francisco State, and I wrote a book about Ramparts magazine called A Bomb in Every Issue. My job here today is to moderate the panel, even though I don't think the verb moderate is really on point for the life and work of Warren Hinkle. Not a great fit with the topic. And I want to lay down a marker right away by saying that for all the credit that Warren has received over the years, I think he remains one of the most underrated figures in the annals of American journalism. Even in the Bay Area, where Warren lived and worked, most people don't realize that he made history at least three times. First as the editor of Ramparts magazine, where he turned a Catholic literary quarterly into a legendary San Francisco muckraker. That's number one. Then as the person who fired Jan Wenner, laid off Jan Wenner, and infuriated Ralph J. Gleason, thereby helping to launch Rolling Stone magazine, somewhat unintentionally. And then finally, as the person who paired Hunter S. Thompson with Ralph Steadman for the first time at, and thereby birthing gonzo journalism at Scanlon's Monthly. And he did all this before he turned 35. So we're talking about a very remarkable achievement here today. I would go further by saying that one of the reasons I think he's an underrated figure is that he did that work here in San Francisco. And, there's been a lot, we could go on and on about sort of centers of power and media power and where they are and where they aren't. But we did an event, actually Warren and his family was there. It was at the San Francisco Public Library. And the person who arranged it after the event said at one point, now that I've heard the whole story, it seems to me that if Ramparts magazine had been published in New York City, there would have been a Broadway musical about it 20 years ago. So I'm sure we'll get to all this and more, and I want to turn to our panelists. I'll also note that we're going to reserve some time for questions at the end after we discuss Warren's life and work. We've got the usual reminders about turning off your phones. We're going to have book signings in the lobby after this, and we're going to be talking in particular about two books. One that Steve will be talking about called Ransoming Pagan Babies. It's the selected writings of Warren Hinkle. And the other is Warren's final book, Who Killed Hunter S. Thompson, which I think was going into production the very week that he passed away in August of 2016. So let me get to our introductions here. I want to start with Robert Scheer, who is the Vietnam correspondent, managing editor, and editor-in-chief at Ramparts magazine, where he worked closely with Warren. So closely, in fact, that Jessica Mitford had a name for them as a kind of single unit, Hink Scheer. And otherwise, she referred to Warren as Hink III, I think, because he was Warren James Hinkle III. After his Ramparts stint, Bob served as a national correspondent and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, and the nationally syndicated column that he started there, now based at Truthdig, where the award-winning news website where he's editor-in-chief. For many years, you probably know that he appeared on NPR's Left, Right, and Center, now teaches communications at USC. Along the way, he's written 10 books, the most recent of which is They Know Everything About You, How Data Collecting Corporations and Snooping Government Agencies Are Destroying Democracy. Fairly timely topic. We also have Steve Wasserman, who serves as the publisher of Heyday Books here in Berkeley. It was Steve's idea to publish Ransoming Pagan Babies earlier this year. That was co-edited by Emmerich Anklam. Before returning to Berkeley, where he grew up, Steve has served as an editor at Yale University Press. He served as a literary agent. I'm not going to get all these, but it's an impressive array of appointments. Editorial director of Times Books, publisher of Hill and Wang and the Noonday Press, editor-in-chief of New Republic Books, editor of the Los Angeles Times Book Review, and an assistant editor at City Magazine when Warren was running that shop, with funding from Francis Ford Coppola. Finally, we have award-winning journalist Pia Hinkle, Warren's daughter. Pia's book, The Court That Tamed the West, was published by Heyday before the Wasserman era. It shows how the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California has defined the nation's geography, culture, and commerce. Pia also helped Ron Turner publish Who Killed Hunter S. Thompson, the long-awaited volume from Last Gasp Press that Warren finalized just before he passed away in August 2016. We were hoping to have Ron Turner here today, publisher of Last Gasp Press, but unfortunately he had to withdraw due to a broken leg. So we'll rely on Pia to help us understand that book's origin and development, as well as her father's life and legacy. So let's start with Warren's life and work then, and work toward these two recent books. Bob, according to my calculations, as far as this panel goes, you knew Warren longer than any of us. How did you meet him? What were your first impressions? And how would you describe your working relationship with him at Ramparts?
Well, first of all, I want to challenge the thing you said. If we had been on the East Coast, we would have been better known. If we would have been on the East Coast, we would have gone unpublished. The reality is, fake news, which is now, and I told you, I flew up here and I'm going to fly back tonight, so I'm in a little pissed off mood. But I do want to make a few things clear right at the outset?
Of course, Bob.
Okay. First of all, there are great stories about Warren. Warren was a great character. I could tell you stories all night long. But that's not why I'm here. Warren was a great journalist. He took it very seriously, and reason he was so committed to journalism is he was opposing fake news as a child, and it was the fake news from the Catholic Church. And the title of the book that Steve brought out, on pagan babies, my own wife went through this Catholic education, and the whole pagan baby idea was fake news. You're going to grab the souls of these people in the third world and buy them off for about 15 minutes, and then God won't notice that this whole thing was nuts. And Hinkle saw through the Catholic Church. He saw through the reactionary politics, the Cold War politics of Cardinal Spellman, McIntyre in Los Angeles, and so forth. And so he was full of strong conviction about this. He hooked up with an ex-Catholic convert, Ed Keating, whose wife fortunately had a bunch of shopping centers that we could sell periodically and pay for it. And I'm not saying that in a disparaging way. I think most of interesting journalism in America came about that way. The Nation magazine, and it's, I think, 140 years now, never had one year where they claimed they made a profit. So a lot of this good journalism is really quite by accident, and people stepping up to help when they've got some resources. I'm not putting it down. But Ed Keating had some sort of idealistic view about the church. We had Pope John then. We had, the Pagma Terrace, whatever the hell it is, I'm not in that church, but a great peace document. We had the farm workers emerging that were, Cesar Chavez was driven by a kind of progressive Dorothy Day Catholicism. And so there was a great deal of idealism about this Ramparts enterprise before I ever got involved. And I just want to be clear, and they did great journalism. They were a quarterly. They called themselves a Catholic Literary Quarterly. I'm not going to go through the list of famous writers they had, but they are legendary in the Catholic Reform New Thinking movement. And I just don't want to keep up the myths. And it goes to the question of why Warren doesn't get the credit he deserves, is because it's much easier to tell wonderful, funny stories. But what drove Warren was journalism. and a reckoning to expose the fake news he was educated in his long Catholic education and to try to figure out what's going on. That's the only reason I got to be involved. I was the first non-Catholic, the first Jew in the door. I kept pointing out my father was a Protestant, but my mother's half carried the day. They wanted a Jew in the door. But the reason for my getting there and reason for Rampart's taking its more left political swing after the quarterly business was that I had stories that you couldn't get published. I'd already done a book about U.S.-Cuban relations. I'd been a graduate student over at Berkeley. I'm only telling you about myself, trying to explain how important Warren was for me. I had the academic credentials. Penguin had published my book on Cuba. I perished publishing because Cold War hawks were in charge of much of our university, and the one good guy, Franz Sherman, was out of the country that year. He would have saved my ass. I was at the Center for Chinese Studies, and I got involved in a place called Vietnam because I was working at City Lights Books for Lawrence Ferlinghetti after they took away my fellowship, and I was interested in this place that people didn't know much about, and I did some reporting on it, and I uncovered something that you have in your book, the Vietnam lobby and the role of the Catholic Church, and no one would touch it. And just by coincidence, my girlfriend and then wife at the time, Ann Wiles, who's a great lawyer now and prison reform and everything, happened to be working with Denise Hinkle, Warren's wife, at a mutual bonds place on Montgomery Street. And they talked about, what does your husband do, or your boyfriend? And she told about Warren, and then Ann told her, well, he's doing all this stuff about a place called Vietnam and how we're getting in deeply involved, and it's going to be terrible, and the Catholic Church is up to its eyeballs in it, and no one will touch it because they don't want to challenge the Catholic Church. And Denise Hinkle said, are you kidding? That's what my husband lives for. You know, and so the marriage was born, and Warren had the guts to take on this issue, and it didn't mean just taking on the Catholic Church. It meant taking on conventional wisdom of a hawkish kind, including the Kennedy administration, which after all got us into the confrontation with Castro and got us into the confrontation over Vietnam. So we were very early, and I just want to throw in one little footnote about the fake news and the great mainstream press. The New York Times and the Washington Post, all these people were cheerleaders for this latest manifestation of the Cold War, as they've been for every war. It wasn't just Hearst who said, give us the photos, we'll give you the war. And I remember very clearly what happened there. We had Frank Church, senator from Idaho, happened to be a Catholic. And he raised some questions about what was going on, our support of Diem, what was going on in Vietnam and everything. And he was raised, and Warren, to his credit, got a hold of Frank Church and asked him to write for us. And he did. And that's what put Rampart's on the map initially, is that the New York Times ran a story, I believe it was a front page story, saying this Catholic senator has challenged what the U.S. is doing in support of the Diem administration, which, after all, I don't know if you know, 10% of Vietnam, thanks to French missionaries, Vietnam was Catholic, 90% were Buddhists, and so forth. And he's now backing the new George Washington of Vietnam and so forth. So they gave Rampart his first break in the New York Times, hiding behind a Catholic senator, because they thought maybe it's time to raise some questions. So just to conclude my little part, I think it's in your book, I don't know where, or maybe in your book, great book, by the way. Very often, you know, people write about something you know a lot about, and you say, oh, you didn't get this right, or you didn't, you know, blah, blah, blah. I could not be happier than with his book. And I read it quite late, and he wasn't going to change very much. When I met him, I had ducked his calls. I didn't want to really talk about it. Great book. But I think it's in your book where Warren Hinkle says, it wasn't that we were so great, it was just that the rest of the media was so lousy. Is that your book?
Yeah. Well, you're cleaning it up a little bit. Yeah.
What did he say?
It's a family show, you know, but I asked him that directly, why he thought Rampart's was able to do so much, and he sort of thought about it. It was kind of a humble reply. He just said, the rest of the press was so shitty, I think, you know. So, and I, you know, it was a real opportunity for him to burnish his legend, and he completely passed on it, which made an impression on me too. Pia, let's address the stereotypes here a little bit more. Bob sort of started us down this road. People think San Francisco in the 60s, you think radical politics, you think counterculture, or you think campus activists, but your father never fit that description very well. How would you describe his background and worldview? It's no accident, of course, that he started at Ramparts when it was a Catholic literary quarterly.
Well, I was born in the 60s, so I don't remember that part. Yeah. But
that meant you had a good time.
Yeah. As a baby.
Maybe that's why you were born.
I think that's probably why I was born. I mean, that was one of the interesting things reading in Babe and Babies, a lot of his earlier work, which I really had never read before, and the publishing dates were around when I was born or around when my sister was born or, you know, when I was a young child, and all of this was going on mm-hmm. in our household. But my dad was a San Franciscan. I mean, he was born in West Portal, which is the western side of town, in an Irish Catholic family. His mother, my grandmother Angela, was a survivor of the 1906 earthquake. She was a very devout Catholic, enthusiastic Catholic, and sort of, you know, shepherded him through Catholic school. He was an altar boy. He went to Archbishop Reardon High School, which was and remains a very conservative all-boys Catholic school in the city. And that early experience with the hypocrisy of the church, not just the pagan babies, but individual priests, I mean, the sort of the dichotomy of the church, how there could be these brilliant philosopher Jesuits who he met, and yet these, you know, sort of horrible, pimply, hypocritical priests as well. And that the church held both those pieces. And I think that as he evolved with journalism too, it was the journalism and the social justice parts of the church that he gravitated towards and was able to use journalism as the vehicle to try to make things right from a Catholic perspective as well as from a journalist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Steve, how about you? Tell us about how you met Warren and what sort of impression he made on you. We're pushing ahead historically a little bit, although I think we'll be backtracking a little bit too.
Well, I owe my meeting Warren to Scheer, with whom, well, this goes back to some ancient history. It's now 2018, so 52 years ago, in 1966, when Bob ran for Congress in the 7th Congressional District here in Berkeley, Oakland, garnering 45% of the vote, making possible the election.
One of my supporters.
Yes. Making possible 2 years later the election of Ronald Dellums, campaigning on a two-pronged platform of ending the war in Vietnam and ending poverty in Oakland, while simultaneously presiding over this magazine, which enjoyed a huge spike in circulation as the country increasingly embraced a sort of countercultural politics. Ramparts was in my household, and I worked in the campaign, as was said, you know, just door to door, bearing a button that said, "I'm a nervous Nelly for Scheer." Nervous Nelly having been the phrase the Johnson administration had used to deride those who had lost faith in the policies being pursued. And then time passed, and in 1974, a senior at Berkeley, Scheer was kind enough to invite me to be his researcher for a book he was writing, which ultimately would be called America After Nixon, The Age of the Multinationals, which attempted to describe what more recently has been called the phenomenon of globalism, but which we understood at the time to be, well, how shall I put it, imperialism. at any rate, during the writing of that time, Scheer received the galleys of a memoir by Warren Hinkle, which was called If You Have a Lemon, Make Lemonade, which was subtitled An Essential Memoir of a Lunatic Decade. And the galleys were sent to Bob, and as we were working on the book, he would spend time reading through the galleys, which Warren had sent as a courtesy to make sure that all the facts were correct. And as Bob lay on a couch, as I recall, reading these pages, which were falling to the floor, I would hear occasional, not exactly groans, but you know, there was a palpable manifestation of this thing or that thing. And when I read the book, which I urge you all to read when you find it, it is a terrifically energetic sprint through a packed 5 years of remarkable magazine, social history, cultural history. There's oxygen in every sentence. And as I would later come to know, when I would meet some of these characters, that the stories he was telling there in those pages, which seemed to stretch credulity to the breaking point, I would later learn that despite his gifts as raconteur, at least in my experience, every story told was true, even the most unbelievable ones. A year later, Bob is working as a columnist for City Magazine of San Francisco, and I was invited to join the staff as an assistant editor. And so it became my job to sort of learn at the knee of a figure who had loomed large in my universe and whom I came to know reasonably well. And then when City Magazine folded on Valentine's Day 1976, as Francis Coppola took out a second mortgage on his Pacific Heights mansion to finance the making of Apocalypse Now, and the place was shuttered, the locks changed, and we all pilfered the place. I still have the two-volume Third International Webster's Dictionary, which Hinkle said, grab the dictionary, Wasserman, hold on to it. I still have that. Then he hired me at $150 a week to work with him on a book he would write with Bill Turner, the late Bill Turner, about the CIA's secret war against Castro. And I was something of a Cuba buff in those years. And just to make the long story slightly longer, in the decades since, we remained in touch and would occasionally see each other, and I learned many things at the knee of Warren Hinkle. And as I made my way through publishing, I always wanted to publish a collection of his writings, because unfortunately, as Oscar Wilde once said of himself, that he used his talent for his work, but he reserved his genius for his life. And in some ways, Warren Hinkle, as colorful character, has obscured the achievement of his own writings. And it was my mission when I came back 18 months ago to my natal ground in Berkeley, I reached out to Warren, who I did not know at that time was really mortally ill. But thanks to Pia, received a blessing that and his permission to put together a selection of his work. And I knew, I felt, that a lot of this work, when put together, would be the equal of any of the collections I had been midwife to publishing in years prior, whether Murray Kempton, a selection of Bob's own writings, or Christopher Hitchens, or the like. And the goal for Ransoming Pagan Babies was to restore or to show people that the influence of his writings and the oxygen in every sentence still inspires and is inspiriting. And one of the things that comes across most clearly is that ideologically, Warren took no prisoners. He was on the side of the little person. It was the haves, the constant battle between the haves and the have-nots, and his suspicion of the powerful and the ways that they wreak havoc and inflict injustice on the least among us. And he was the most generous of people in that way. He couldn't bear hypocrisy. He was a scourge of the powerful, and I thought there was a real legacy there, and it was something important to put together so that people could see and judge for themselves.
I want to echo that because I reviewed this book for the San Francisco Chronicle, and I was really struck by the range and versatility of Warren's writing over the years. I also would mention, also echoing Steve, that the one of the things about Warren is that he had that kind of California sprezzatura. You know, he had that studied nonchalance. And sometimes people see it and they think, oh, that when you make it look easy, people think it's easy. People in the business know it's not easy, and I think that's why Warren gets a lot of respect from the people who do this for a living. And, you know, I think that was sort of a, that was a moment in time. I think it's still true in part of Californians who hit the national stage, like Joe DiMaggio. You know, he made it look easy, and that's beautiful. But in some ways, nobody underestimates Joe DiMaggio, but in some ways I think, and because of his editorial achievements, I think, and because of his large personality, sometimes the writing, you know, got lost. And I'm really grateful for Steve for bringing out this compilation, Bob.
Yeah, I want to comment on that. And this shouldn't be just a love fest here. I think Warren was his own worst enemy at the end. I quite coincidentally was talking to Gavin Newsom the other day. I don't know what Warren wrote about him, but he sure didn't leave Gavin Newsom being too happy with him. And we talked about Warren, and yet through Warren, I had met Gavin's father. I met a lot of people in San Francisco, Howard Gossage. I met, you know, he had a whole running thing with Herb Cain forever. And I was thinking about a lot about it, you know. I like Warren. First of all, he's a great writer, no question about it, and very, very smart in every way. And I agree with what was said about the book. The writing is brilliant. You want to know about Oakland? Go read the essay in Oakland about Oakland in this book. Everything else is bullshit. You know, and he really predicts the whole where Oakland is now, where it's been, why we didn't end poverty, why gentrification, the whole thing. He goes through it brilliantly, the old Nolan family, everything. And so reading this book, Steve's book, the Heyday book, for me was a really eye-opener in terms of how strong the writing was, continuing very much so to the end. I'm not taking anything away. But I think Warren got trapped into playing a certain character role. People encouraged it, a lot to have to do with the drinking, which was not always wonderful, and you know, a certain persona. And I was thinking a lot about Warren lately, because we did another program earlier. One of Warren's great strengths was his seriousness of purpose, which is always left out. And I can know it's a downer. You're before an audience, and they want to hear Weill Hinkle stories. And I trust me, I had plenty of them. I can tell you about my being on the second floor ledge of an heiress's house when her boyfriend, her fiancé, came home, and I was supposed to be collecting checks for Ramparts. You know, we had a lot of those, and wild times and everything. But that all through it, Warren, first of all, was always attracted to really interesting, strong people. And he listened to them. Decca Mitford, who was mentioned before, you know, living in Oakland, but an international legend, right? Married to a very important, clear-thinking lawyer, Bob Truhap. Warren never, I mean, he's thrilled to Decca Mitford. Thrilled to her, you know? And she would not suffer fools. She would take Warren to task. She would tell him he's being foolish, and so on. Dougal Sturmer, who doesn't get enough credit for Ramparts. Dougal Sturmer made Ramparts. He was our conscience. He would say, hey, this is bullshit. No one's going to know what you're talking about. He was the lifeguard from L.A. who was really smart and a great art director, courageous as can be. He's the one who invented Rolling Stone, by the way. It was done in our office. Dougal Sturmer was the one who designed the whole thing and everything else. And Jan Wenner, you know, looked up to him. He was the guy who made Ramparts. And what I wanted to say about Hinkle is he was always drawn to these people. They did not humor him. You know, if you look down the list, Dr. Jerry Fagan, I could go. I remember the place was always, you know, swarming with people. Betty Shabazz, when she came in that famous standoff with the drawn guns and all that. I mean, it's just no end. Bill Turner, FBI agent, you know, one person after another. And Warren was a very good listener, which is why he was a great journalist. He was at his best when he was actually reporting. He was terrific in reporting. And so I don't want to leave that out. What the reason I think Warren is ignored, and your book captures it, it's really his success is a rebuke of mainstream journalism. Mainstream journalism doesn't like to be rebuked in this way. The fact of the matter is they sat quietly by while atrocities were done in the world. After all, the powerful scene in your book is about Martin Luther King. You know, Martin Luther King's decision to come out against the war in Vietnam, which was condemned editorially in the New York Times. He's dividing the civil rights movement. Editorial, attacking him for giving the great Riverside Church speech. Okay? And as you correctly point out, Martin Luther King came upon that because Warren had the courage and Dougal Sturmer to get William Pepper, who was taking these incredible photographs about what carpet bombing does. It's going to talk about terrorism. You know, I had been in Vietnam that before I met Warren after, and you know, I went there north, south, the whole bloody thing and everything. And Pepper captured this with his photographs, and Warren had the courage to print them. And Dougal had the courage to print, you know, and they were gruesome. This is what bombs do. Blows off half a face, destroys three limbs, you know? Yes, yes, yes. And Martin Luther King saw that in, what was it, the Atlanta airport?
Boston.
I know that story. Yeah. And that's Hinkle's thing. Hey, I mean, I don't want to leave out with all the great, a lot of the bullshit, the Blarney, all the stuff, the Irish crap. I kept pointing out to Warren, you're not really Irish. You know, you, goddamn, your father, I mean, there's a German in there just like my German father, you know? And they weren't so exciting, and when they drank, they became boring, you know? We'd have discussions about this all the time. But the fact of the matter is, Warren was deadly serious about exposing wrongdoing, and he was always on the side of the little guy, or the little woman, okay? He was, very early on. And that's why he supported the farm workers and understood the significance of that movement. And I just don't want to leave that out. Why don't you tell the King story? Because I think, I mean, it was probably the most influential thing that Ramparts did was forcing a connection between the anti-Vietnam movement and the civil rights movement. We were probably as critical as any other publication in doing that, and that was Warren's doing.
Yeah, he was working very hard. He needed a vacation. Dr. King went to the airport and was just flipping through magazines that he found at the news rack. That's one of Rampart's great achievements. It was on news racks. You know, a lot of leftist magazines, you know, were not getting that kind of circulation. He bought a bunch of them and was flipping through them, and he was at lunch with a colleague, and he just kind of pushed his plate away. And his colleague said, "Well, is there something wrong with the food?" He said, "No, there's nothing wrong with the food, but we got to stop this war." He had looked at a photo essay, and you know, you don't often get that in journalism, where you know, a world historical actor makes a decision based on something that they read in real time. And as Bob said, he was criticized for that because it would seem to, in some ways, divert energy away from the civil rights movement, but. Of course, he ended up making a very important speech, which Ramparts ran.
And we ran because no one else ran it. Everybody forgets, you know. Here he's at Riverside Church in New York. We don't even have video of the bloody thing, you know, because they didn't bother covering it. And I got, Cora Weiss got me the tape. I said, "No one's printing this speech anywhere." And I said, "Can you get me the tape? We'll run it." You know, and that was the first record that Martin Luther King, that's when he called the U.S. the major purveyor of violence in the world today. I think it's his most important speech, frankly. And he talked about, what does nonviolence mean? What am I going to preach in the ghettos in America about nonviolence? And then you draft these same kids and send them to go over and kill people, you know, in a war you have no business doing. It was an incredibly courageous thing, and you couldn't get a bloody text of it. You know, and you know, Cora sent us a copy of it. And so I just do think, and that was Warren. Warren had, what, I forget all these people, Geismar, who's the guy that made himself look black and go to the South?
John Howard
Griffin. Yes. John Howard Griffin, right. Black, yeah. Like me.
And you Thomas know, Merton's stuff was running in.
Yeah, I mean, he just, I mean, who's the great writer about the South? I mean, he had all of these people early in Rampart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and he understood the significance of the civil rights movement. He just right down the line was way ahead of everybody and had the guts to do it, you know. And then we go to New York. They only covered our stories, you know, when they had to. You know, they had to. When we exposed the CIA, you know, and what it was doing and all that, then they had to run it.
Yeah.
We had the documents. And what we really were the start of a kind of whistleblower journalism. Mm-hmm. People knew you can't get this in anywhere else. We'll give it to Ramparts and we'll get it. And we had these stories flooding in. And that was,
And that was part of Warren's gift, was the showmanship. I mean, he published them in a way that made it impossible for the other media outlets to ignore these stories.
Well, this is an aspect that shouldn't be slighted, and nor should a seriousness of purpose be seen as synonymous with a certain earnest, solemn, unhumorous approach. I mean, Warren perfectly embodied the idea that you could be an impresario of the best kind of journalism and also tackle both strategically and practically the idea of cutting through the noise of the culture to get attention for deserving work, and that in the doing of it you could have enormous fun, that no movement worth participating in, he didn't want to turn himself into a kind of the kind of plaster saint that he had tried to take a hammer to at the Catholic Church. He wanted to, have to liberate himself from all of that. One of the things about Warren that was so refreshing was indeed in those pages of Ramparts that Dougal Sturmer so brilliantly designed, the mix of things. They didn't want it to look like gray pages of type that looked like manifestos. Warren was a connoisseur of font and typography, and he would be, as Pia has pointed out to me in a near channeling of admonishment from her late father, he would have been a bit unhappy with this book that we've done our best to publish, because I left out all the illustrations and cartoons and photographs. There's just too much gray type in it. But I do want to leave you with one thing. I want the man to speak for himself. I do want to go back to the writing. It's really important. And just to give you a flavor, I'm going to read you one sentence. I'm not going to bore you with more. In a piece that he's writing about a guy who's living in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, forgotten, who had once been one of the great concert pianists and had a kind of Glenn Gould before Glenn Gould, but who was living in poverty in San Francisco, and who Warren encounters and learns that the guy had once had this great career in New York, and at one point, having fallen on harder times, he made money by playing for mobsters in Italian social clubs in Little Italy. And he writes, afterward, outside a Little Italy restaurant in a light snow that bleached the night sky, as the mafiosi, their bellies full of culture, drove off in their black machines, he stood alone, reading by streetlight of the wreck of his marriage in the early edition of the Daily News. I mean, we're in, you know, Edward Hopper land here. I also want to talk just a little bit about the way in which the heresies of Hinkle in his refusal to swallow the catechism of the Catholic Church inoculated him against nostrums of all kinds. And in a front cover piece he had done for Ramparts in March of 1967 called The Social Life of the Hippies, a piece which was quite controversial at the time. Ralph Gleason, who had been on staff at Ramparts, resigned from the magazine, so appalled was he by Hinkle's refusal to romanticize the hippies. But in so doing, Warren anticipates Altamont only a few years later in a stunning line, which when I unearthed the piece as I was going through these past pieces of Warren, I about fell off the chair. Here's the last paragraph of this piece that appeared in Ramparts, March 67. The danger in the hippie movement is more than overcrowded streets and possible hunger riots this summer. that would be the summer of love, as was so recently, you know, canonized here in San Francisco just a few months ago. If more and more youngsters begin to share the hippie political posture of unrelenting quietism, the future of activist serious politics is bound to be affected. The hippies have shown that it can be pleasant to drop out of the arduous task of attempting to steer a difficult, unrewarding society. But when that is done, you leave the driving to the Hell's Angels.
You know, Thank you, Steve.
What you were saying also made me think of the showmanship and sort of the fun in promoting these causes and stories was the influence of Howard Gossage on my dad. And Howard Gossage was a sort of genius early advertising man in San Francisco in the 60s, and I don't even know exactly how they met. You might know, Bob. But he became my father's
cookie
mentor.
Cookies.
He became my father's mentor and really like a father figure, and he died very tragically in his early 60s of leukemia suddenly, and it was devastating to my dad. But Gossage really believed that journalism should be so good that people will pay what it's worth, and that you could make it exciting and worth the real $5 that it costs for the newspaper or the magazine. And if you did it right, that's people would be willing and happy to pay for it. And he thought that advertising in journalism was basically the death of journalism, because then you were a slave to your advertisers in the end. So he took that to heart, and also Gossage was a brilliant promoter and marketer. So these ideas, when they would take out, you know, full page ads in the New York Times and spend like thousands and thousands of dollars, which back then was like a fortune, to promote stories. And it was right literally in the Times' face. Like, they couldn't ignore these stories, and politicians couldn't ignore the stories. And then more than that, I think, I don't know if it was Gossage, or he always quoted Gossage as saying that, you know, a man doing the serious work of saving the world should always go first class. And so that was part of the permission to, you know, indulge in really ludicrous editorial expenses, like taking a cab from New York to Chicago, or, you know, staying at the Algonquin constantly, and all of the good times that he had doing this work.
Let me defend the spending.
He would be very happy to hear you say.
We always went bankrupt, so we didn't have to pay the bills anyway. We discovered the delights of Chapter 11 bankruptcy. But actually, I went to work for the LA Times and was there for 29 years after Warren and blah, blah, blah. Mainstream. The LA Times always flew first class. They always stayed at the best hotels. Really what Warren was doing, he had been at the Chronicle before. He had come out of conventional. In fact, Warren, somebody should give Warren. Warren is the guy who stopped the freeway from going right through the middle of San Francisco. That's what he did before Ramparts. I knew about Warren because I knew there was this crazy guy at the Chronicle who said, there's this massive citizens movement to stop the freeways from destroying this fine city, you know, and there's going to be a rally of hundreds of thousands. I thought, how do you write a story? There's going to be a rally of hundreds of thousands. And then, in fact, 25 people would show up, and then that would be forgotten. And the next story would say, larger crowds are anticipated by organizers of the thing. But the fact is, he stopped it. We had our office eventually after we got out of Menlo Park, the hell of a Menlo Park. We moved to Sansom and Broadway. And then at the bottom, we could see where the freeway stopped. And that was Warren's achievement. No other person deserves, I mean, he deserves maybe 90% of the credit for stopping the freeway thing. And I want to make something about, another point about the San Francisco origins of this stuff. Warren loved San Francisco. Now, he was a square in many ways, you know. But the fact, there was a lot of it, he admired the history of the city. He understood why Harry Bridges and the old communists were important. He understood, you know, the Chinese community and the Exclusion Act and the discrimination against the Chinese and what that had done. He understood the emerging gay movement. After all, he ended up living on Castro Street, which, you know, ended up being central, but he understood. He understood Harry Bridges. And he brought, and also, amazingly enough, he liked strong women. You know, we had a very strong, got us in a little bit of trouble, but we had Susie Lydon's first piece on Is There a Female Orgasm? Which, you know, you may not know, was in question for many a century in this country. And I think Ramparts was the first one to celebrate the possibility of women getting off on sex and enjoying it in that way. He loved not only Desi Missed, but we printed, 18,000 words from Susan Sontag on Sweden. You know, pretty intense writing about Sweden. He was always, if you look at the collection of the people he hung out with, there wasn't just the males that was strong. We had a very strong female presence in the office. And his wife, his mother, I think without Denise Hinkle, there was no Ramparts. Because she was always the one who said, Warren, knock it off, or you do have to go to work, or you can't spend all that much money, and you can't drive that car because you can only see out of one eye, and you keep smashing into things, and so forth. So there was an adult influence in his life. I do want to say something about Gossage, and again, it's a tribute to San Francisco. These were, yes, we even Honig gave us money, not the one that ended up being Secretary of Education, but his father, another even more respectable advertising guy, and we got a lot of support from the San Francisco community. We did, and they liked the fact that there were these people kicking ass and doing stuff, and it traced back through the Beatniks, which again were really, you know. And I don't know his feeling about, you say this about the Haight-Ashbury and all that. It was conflicted. We knew. I mean, first of all, we were starting when Ramparts. We still had. Just a little bit earlier, Lenny Bruce was performing in North Beach. Our editorial meetings were, you know, right in all these restaurants and Vesuvio's and all these places. And we were part of that culture. And I don't think, Warren was, first of all, Ralph Gleason was very critical to our enterprise. And yes, he broke over that attack, but it was Hinkle who brought Gleason into Ramparts, and we were friends with the people over, you know, in that mime troupe, and you know, Ronnie Davis and Bill Graham and all these people. We were not cut off from that culture at all. You know, I think Hinkle admired it. He just, you know, but yes, he the sickness of Hinkle from my point of view. Is I couldn't see why you want to sit in some miserable old Irish bar and talk to cops, you know? And that was the way Hinkle relaxed, right?
But it was more than that, because
that's good.
We shouldn't leave you with the impression that only the best work was done in these brief years at Ramparts. On offer in this book is the most nuanced, thoughtful, perspicacious anatomy of the killings of Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone, an event that is oddly, I think, largely forgotten in the rest of the country, and maybe even here, not as much. But Warren understood, because he was a fourth generation Californian, because he'd come up in the areas he'd come of age in San Francisco, and because he talked to those cops and befriended them, he had an understanding, as one of the characters in Jules, in Renoir's film, The Rules of the Game, and one of the characters toward the end says, the problem in the world is that everybody has his reasons. And Warren understood the deep fears and anxiety of a straight-laced community that was being eclipsed by waves of newcomers to San Francisco that were challenging cultural shibboleths and traditions that had toppled the city into a kind of free fall in which all the older presumptions were under siege, the consequences of which and the implications of which we are living through now, still, decades later. The two pieces included in this Ransoming Pagan Babies, in which he does a deep dive into the Moscone, Milk, and Dan White imbroglio is well worth your time. And he writes that, and he reports that in a way that has deep feeling for the torments that plagued every section of San Francisco in that period, and as I say, whose consequences are still being lived out today.
Strong figures. And turning to our other book here, Who Killed Hunter S. Thompson, which I know you had a lot to do with, and I want to ask you about that. You know, he's one of those figures, clearly. I mean, the history is quick to tell. Warren leaves Ramparts Magazine when it first files for bankruptcy. Bob takes over as editor there. Dugald stays for a little while. Bob and Dugald stay for a little while. But your father goes and starts Scanlon's magazine. He runs a piece by Hunter Thompson in the first issue. And then they basically co-create gonzo journalism with the Kentucky Derby as Decadent and Depraved. And this really launches Hunter Thompson's career as a gonzo journalist. It's really the first piece of gonzo journalism. He'd done the Hell's Angels book. That did very well, but it's not gonzo. So toward the end of your father's life, that's what he's thinking about, that's what he's writing about. Of course, he's also writing about these other adventures as well. But tell us a little bit about that relationship between those two men. They spent some time together in the 80s, and that's sort of at the center of this book, and I want to talk a little bit more about his concerns there.
I mean, Hunter killed himself in 2005, and immediately afterwards, I don't think my dad was surprised. I mean, they had been very close friends, and he knew that Hunter was in a lot of pain and was a gun lover and was a control freak and, you know, was going to make his destiny, live his life to the end the way he had always lived it, which was how he wanted things to go. So after he died, he immediately thought, you know, we have to do a book. And because they were both huge conspiracy theorists, he was like, the title has to be Who Killed Hunter S. Thompson, right? So he began contacting, they had a lot of friends in common, and began contacting those people and asking them to write a story. And there's the stories in there are really, really wonderful. The first one is by this guy, John Clancy, who was Hunter's roommate in New York. And Clancy was at Columbia, and Hunter had dropped out of, he had been honorably discharged from the Army and had dropped out of school, but he was in New York studying, doing something anyway, so he ended up being roommates with Clancy. Clancy later became, met my mom's brother, Mark LaBarle, who was at Columbia. They became friends, and Clancy later was, I mean, he was part of my family's life going on. He was off and on served as a counselor and lawyer. He was Hunter, one of the models for Hunter's lawyer. There's like three different lawyers who are the model for, you know, sort of, So the story that John Clancy writes about their early years together, and it's really wonderfully written, is priceless. But I mean, everyone is in there who knew him, stories, and so then my father, of course, had to write this introduction, which is 212 pages. and the introduction tells how they first met and how they really connected immediately as kindred spirits, not just in you know, calling out hypocrisy, using journalism to search for justice, but also on art and design. And he writes a lot about how Hunter also was sort of obsessed with typefaces and layouts and art, and how the power of journalism through words is still not quite enough. You know, you got to dress it up a little bit, right? And so they were both. Like, he gave him the title, I forget, for one of the magazines of, like, he said he was assistant art director at Stanford or something. Like, Hunter loved the layout of magazines. And so did my dad. That was one of his most brilliant things that I saw with him, was he could lay out a dummy for a magazine and just make it flow, like what the cover needed to be, what the impact needed to be, what to do with the words to make them not just be a page of words. So the book, though, took up to the end of his life, so literally more than 10 years right. to finish, sort of finish.
I saw the promotional materials in Los Angeles about 12 years ago.
Yes, exactly. So that was, you know, sort of the long-running joke when people would ask Ron Turner, who was very sorry he couldn't be here today, you know, what's happening with the Hunter book? And he would just say, Hinkle. And that's been sort of a despairing cry of various publishers through the years with my dad.
Yes, I remember a time that when I was working closely with Warren, he was supposedly doing a book for, I think it was Little Brown, I'm not sure, for a New York publisher, and he had submitted it and said it was done because he wanted the rest of the advance of monies. And the publisher read it and said, but there's no ending. So he sent it back to Warren. And I remember Warren waited 3 months. He thought it was a decent amount of time. And he sent back the same book, except he typed on the last page, the end. And you have it. And he was a genius procrastinator. I never saw, and you'll forgive me if I do say this in a public setting, but to be honest, he does compel. I never saw anyone with as much talent throw it away so deliberately. I have to say that. One of the tragedies, I think, of Warren was that while it's true that many people thought, not unreasonably, that he spent more of his life bellied up to a saloon bar than at his writing desk, although very often the two were synonymous. And then one of the reasons to have published this book is to show that really quite a lot of very good work got done. But I saw Warren, I was in awe of his ability to edit a story. You know, commonly writers would come into Cookie Pichetti's and give him a story from City Magazine, and he'd fan out the manuscript like a deck of cards, and I never saw anyone, he was the first person I ever saw, maybe the last person I ever saw, you know, edit with a red felt pen,
his favorite,
you know, and he would look at it, and he would sort of look at it and say, oh, well, this goes here, that goes there, and there'd be arrows in here, and no, take this off and get rid of the first three pages. The real lead is over there. And he was almost unerringly correct. There's a story, perhaps apocryphal, that I once heard of someone being assigned to do a story at Ramparts. They went away dutifully for some months to do the story, and then so the story went. The writer came back and presented Warren with the story, and Warren receives it and takes the manuscript and cuts it like a deck of cards, weighs up half on one hand, half on the other, drops half of it into the waste paper basket, shoves the remainder at the writer and says, now rewrite it. And of course, this is the kind of story that occurs to me that only should be shared to other editors and never told to aspiring writers. But the truth of the matter was that probably he was right. The story was probably too long by and needed to be cut in half. You know.
Let me correct that story. I'm the one that has spread. First of all, I do want to say one thing. I have stressed Warren's Rampart years, and then I actually ended up not having much of a relationship with him towards the end, because partially for the reason that Steve is talking about, I felt Warren was wasting, as many writers do, his talent, and not always. He could still knock it out of the park, and so forth. But I want to say what Warren did up to the point, let's say 1970, was enough for five lifetimes, okay? I just want to be clear, not to take anything away from the other work. And he had a tremendous, I disagree, he didn't procrastinate, he had tremendous work ethic. He was a bull, first of all. He had incredible physical endurance. I never seen anyone who could go, you know, without sleep, day after day after day, maybe snooze on the couch in the office for an hour or two, and get on airplanes. And I had a hard time keeping up with Warren in that respect, whether it was in Chicago in the middle of, you know, the police riot, Warren putting out the wall poster, whether it was running around when we did the Che Guevara diary, and, you know, and Warren, by the way, could soak up the idiom wherever he was. You know, he could go to Ireland and be with the IRA, and he could be dealing with Castro in Cuba over the Che diaries and so forth. And he could figure out who were the assholes, who were the smart people, who, what part is right and real, and what part is bullshit. And he did it ruthlessly. And I'll give you just one example. We were trying, we're endlessly trying to raise money, okay? And every time, and by the way, it wasn't because of flying first class. That was a garbage, I'm sorry, not to take anything away from you, but that was one way of kind of demeaning what we were up against. All right. Oh, you know, that was David Horowitz, by the way, who ended up, you know, getting control of Ramparts by attacking us from the left before he then becomes a right winger. You know, but that was his idea. We were bourgeois and we were living the high life and staying at good hotels and all that. And that was garbage. We lost money because of the positions we took. All right, Six-Day War happens, okay, and Michael Ansara, who was our stringer at Harvard, you know, asked me if I want to go over there, and his father, who had, you know, was, I think, Lebanese Christian, I'm not sure, but he knew the people in the Arab League, and he knew one of the colonels in Egypt, and when we go, and I went, and I wrote about it, and put us into bankruptcy. When I.F. Stone wrote about the Six-Day War, put us into bankruptcy. I could tell you exactly the issues that we took up when we dared to suggest some support for Malcolm X or the, you know, black nationalism or so forth, and bankruptcy. And it was not accidental. People who were with us, you know, Marty Peretz, who I remember were plotting to get his wife, or future wife's money, and Singer, the Singer sewing fortune and everything like that, and boom, lost it over the Six-Day War, you know? And so it was endless. And I must say, by the way, there were people, I don't want to mock the people who put up money. Fred Mitchell was a guy here in Berkeley, saved Ramparts, you know, and he inherited money from a grandfather who ran a bank in Pennsylvania, and he kept calling a couple of guys called the office, said he'd like to make a contribution. He likes the magazine. Was a guy getting his doctorate in history, and at one point we had to, you know, after all, it's not the internet. We had to deal with the Teamsters. We had to deal with the printer. We had, you know, all this stuff. You know, how do you get the issue away? The guy says, you owe me for 5 issues. I'm not giving you your magazine, you know, or I'm not going to deliver it and so forth. And then Warren said, wasn't there some guy, some historian over there in Berkeley who said he wants to write it? He said, call him up, Bob. You know, so I call up. The guy came up. I don't remember the exact amount, but it was a lot of money. And he said, you know, my grandfather was a man of principle. He would have liked what you're doing. I don't want to live off his money. And I'm going to donate it to you. And that was the way, you know, almost all of the money that came in from people knew what they were doing, why they were contributing it, so I'm not going to put down. But I must say, one reason I could tell a lot of funny Warrens. Warren was a blast. I mean, a tremendous energy, tremendous, he loved people, he loved telling stories, it was great, and so forth. But I do want to stress the seriousness of purpose. And at the end of the day, that's what gained the respect of the good people in the industry. That's why they carried our stories. Whether we were sitting at Elaine's, and Warren was talking to people, I don't care who they were, from the New York Times or elsewhere, people who knew Warren respected him, certainly in the period where I was there. And if Warren said he had a good story, people took him at his word, they read the story, they cared about it, and they were themselves legends in journalism, very often who couldn't get the story into the New York Times. There were plenty of people who gave us a story hoping that it would force the New York Times or the Washington Post to cover that subject. Okay, and thanks to Warren, with using these ads and everything else, Warren knew, yes, we'll scrape up the money. People thought he was crazy, but it worked. We take out a full-page ad in the New York Times, they're going to have to start covering that because the facts were there. And don't forget, you know, there was one or two places where you could question our journalism. I know on the Kennedy assassination, Warren, we went like that. You know, and to this day, I don't agree. Although I think Warren was very correct in calling out the Warren Commission and his contradictions. But we had, at one point, we had kind of people with different theories about the Warren Commission winding around the block. And I got disgusted. You know, I was taking up my whole day entertaining every new theory. And I just banned them all from the office. And Warren was furious. I said, well, then you go talk to him. He's over at that bar, you know, and he'll talk to you. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, Ramparts got it right. I think you mentioned at the beginning. You know, on every major story, I've been talking about my most recent book about the surveillance states and everything, you know, that's what we were exposing in Ramparts. Every single major story we dealt with, you know, as I say, the Oakland story and gentrification. I defy anyone to go back through that and tell us where we sensationalized, or, well, that's a bad word. We certainly promoted effectively, but where we distorted the story, no. You know, I think the journalism holds up incredibly well.
Well, that was Warren's motto, which I think he got from George M. Cohan. Always serve it with a little dressing, and I think that's something to remember. I would also, just by way of conclusion, I want to open the floor to questions here in a sec. But I think Ramparts was a kind of point of origin for a lot of Bay Area journalism, a kind of ecological niche that the Bay Area to this day still occupies in the national media ecology. I mean, there wasn't really anything like Ramparts before Ramparts, but then you had Rolling Stone and Mother Jones and the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal and Salon and some other places as well, all of which kind of trace their origin back to this moment that we've been talking about. So I want to thank the panelists for that discussion. I also want to open this to questions, which we have a few minutes for. Let's keep them brief so that everybody gets a chance. We're going to go with the microphones here.
If you want, you can come up.
So just to respond, the reason Warren went to the conservative bars was he said that there's no such thing as a good liberal bar. Just to follow up on Robert's point, a couple of questions. Number one, what would be the modern day equivalent to Ramparts today? Number two, Warren does mention the 6-day verdict in his book. He mentions a $1 million verdict that caused a bankruptcy. Could you talk more about that? And then the third issue is also what I noticed is that what you did led to a butterfly effect in terms of strengthening anti-war resistance across the country. That anti-war resistance, in turn, gave courage to a lot of people, including Daniel Ellsberg, who took that courage and made it into something worthwhile, and eventually brought down Nixon and saved God knows how many lives. My concern today is, why haven't we seen a similar reaction, given all the wars that we've encountered since Vietnam and lost since Vietnam? And what do you think is the reason for that? And do you think that it's over for America because our youth are not the same as what, don't have the same indignation and work ethic that you're talking about, which is why we're here and why we will continue to be here and why people like me are going to leave the country?
Okay, I do want to answer personally on this respect. First of all, I don't agree. Look, I was up all night long editing Truth Dig, okay? I don't get paid. I don't take money out of it. And I do it, you know, and I teach full time and I work. And I think Truth Dig is in some ways Ramparts on speed, because we got Chris Hedges. We got a lot of people writing stuff that the mainstream media doesn't want to carry. And thanks to the internet, we can reach millions of people and so forth. And a story I posted this morning, which, you know, didn't take any great initiative, it took a little bit of courage, was Amnesty International's attack, criticism of, and calling for a boycott of military sales to Israel because of the wounding or injuring of 5,000 protesters by the Israeli army and Gaza, and the killing of already, you know, maybe 50 people for protesting. And I thought back to Ramparts. I thought, you know, okay, Warren would want me to put this story up. I put the story up, and thanks to the internet, we have a very large number of readers reading a Amnesty International press release. So when I look at it, that's one aspect, that there's good stuff being done by lots of publications. Ramparts was unique because in that universe, after all, you had very limited other outlets, and Warren correctly, I mean, we don't have time to really celebrate all the things about Warren, but Warren loved print, and he loved, you're right, he loved graphics. He loved to talk to printers, you know, and all this stuff. He could get the Teamsters to carry our publication, you know, I mean, the Teamster delivery drivers. But the key thing, answering your question, we have, after the war in Vietnam, we, meaning the government that I have no control over, has figured out how to do war without having a draft, without sacrificing, you know, the lives of people who have, they think, better things to do, better economic opportunity, or what have you. And war now is a video game. What Hinkle was able to do, and what Rampart said, and we haven't mentioned Master Sergeant Don Duncan, which was really absolutely critical, you know, decorated Special Forces hero, you know, who could told us the truth. We had a lot of returning vets coming up with their stories, and it mattered because our readers were going to be drafted. I mean, the main thing about Ramparts is we were targeting the audience to enlighten that the government, right, was trying to, was drafting. I remember, I went, I had to still go every year and spread my cheeks at the Oakland Draft Board and have somebody look up my ass, you know. So we were writing for ourselves. We burned our draft cards on the cover, after all, and were dragged before the grand jury, okay, were threatening us both in New York and San Francisco. Those, you know, our draft card, we were still eligible. I was still 1A. You know, so that gave our magazine an incredible sense of currency and urgency with, say, college audiences, which was our main. The pass around of Ramparts, I hear it to this day. People tell me, when I was in my dorm, wherever they were, we were passing around Ramparts, you know.
Also, you remind me that Bill Turner once said about the Rampart stories, he's the former FBI agent that did some whistleblower stories. He said, he asked at one point, who else would have run these stories, the Saturday Evening Post? So it was a different media ecology.
Yeah, I do want to say about Ellsberg, by the way. Ellsberg is a guy we were very close, I mean, I've been very close to. He lives here, and a great hero. And, you know, and yes, he will tell you that he was influenced by this, I think we helped create an atmosphere in which other people found avenues for it. But the real thing you should think about is the immorality of being able to kill people at random throughout the world. We're still the major purveyor of violence in the world today. Martin Luther King's statement still applies today, okay? Only we can do it in a way that does not disturb the life of most Americans. Well, so that's it. Huh?
Why stay?
Why stay in a country that's a prevailing, like basically everything money?
To stop it.
Because my country, right or wrong, when right, to defend it, when wrong, to correct it. We must wield the rod of correction. All of us together.
Machine.
Yeah. Let me just, I don't want to take time's value, but I do want to say, the great thing about Hinkle, if I had to think of one simple thing, okay, he thought he could reach everybody in the country. Warren was not an elitist. He did not have the idea, I have superior knowledge or thinking. You know, a guy, you know, it sounds strange to compare it to, but you know, friends here, Florence Ferlinghetti. When I think of a number of people that I've met in my life, who were the unalienated, non-alien, I don't know what the grammar is, I'm always correcting my grammar, but they were not alienated from America. They actually thought, I'll give you my 1,000 fearful words for Fidel Castro, and people will respond, okay? Warren had that sense of connection. He did not think he was an intellectual. He did not think he was a bohemian. He did not think he came from some kind of alternative culture. And so when he was sitting there, and you know, took a little courage to go to Cookie Pichetti's, you know, and these other, and wasn't just there. Warren was weighed into any bar in the country and let people know what he was all about. Hey, you want to know what I do? Here's my magazine. Here, read it. You should read it. Check it out, you know. Now we're not commies. Are you kidding? You know, I'm a Catholic, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Maybe we can continue the conversation a little bit more informally. We're going to have books in the lobby. Have a look, please. Please join me in thanking our panelists and our sponsors.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.